pro forma right now.
No, but they'll figure it out. I'm not so worried. Okay.
Rabbi, we're continuing
on
the same from last week, the same?
I sent Rabbi Bressler a new Mara Mekomos packet, and I think he sent it around by email.
He did.
So, yes. Right. Oh. But I only made one copy for myself of it, I think. So I guess that he figured that people would maybe print it out on their computers or their printers. So. No. I actually have an extra copy. Okay, so we'll get started. Maybe we'll give a shorter shiur this evening. This is the second to last installment in this series. I'm planning to complete our discussion regarding adoptions today, and then next week in Yirtzeh Hashem, we'll cover the topic of determining Jewish identity of different discrete populations, such as the Anusim and the Indian Jews and the Ethiopian Jews, just because they each present special challenges in terms of populations that either have a Kabbalah that they're Jewish, but we're sometimes suspicious, or they have a Kabbalah that we have a Kabbalah that they don't seem to be Jewish, like people who come from Mexico and say that they're Anusim, but is there any way that you can come to the conclusion that they're Jewish anyway based on evidence and records that they might bring to bear? And does that affect whether there's a requirement for Geirus or not? So just completing the discussion regarding adoptions. So we mentioned last time, I think we left off, correct me if I'm mistaken, with the Noda B'Yehuda, that there's a famous Noda B'Yehuda in Eben Ezer, Simon Zion, in the Madua Kama of the Chubas of the Noda B'Yehuda, in which he discusses on what basis is it that we can be comfortable relying upon the Yichus of a child that was, raised by a single woman who gave birth to a child, and we don't know who the father was, and the Gemara tells us explicitly that you have to worry about shtuki. So we began a discussion, just to give a little bit of a backdrop, with the question as to whether if somebody is adopted, that raises questions regarding their Jewish identity altogether. We mentioned that there are two possibilities of how one can adopt a child. One can adopt a child who is Jewish, or you can adopt a child who's not Jewish. If you adopt a child who's not Jewish, so then the question of Yichus is obvious because the child's not Jewish. Then the question becomes, was there a proper conversion? Was there not a proper conversion that was performed in the child? The child is Jewish, so then the question becomes, how do you know the child is Jewish? So we discussed that last time. We mentioned that according to the Tzitz Eliezer, you could really rely upon the records of the adoption agency because the adoption agency is very often a governmental entity and also they're professionals. And if they're going to lie, they might be caught in a lie. But we pointed out that they might not be lying. They just might not know what it means for somebody to be Jewish. And therefore, you can't really rely upon that. And that's really the approach which is taken by Rav Moshe Feinstein in his Tshuvos, where he says that, number one, to establish that somebody is Jewish when there isn't previously a chazakah that they're Jewish, that requires two edim. It requires two edim kasherim to establish a person's Jewish identity. If the person themselves really do not know about their Jewish identity. And secondly, he's not so sanguine about the notion that the adoption agencies can be relied upon because he says, sometimes it might be a consideration of l'hashpiach hamekach amushu hushel yehudim that they wanted to embellish their merchandise, so to speak. So if there's a Jewish clientele, so they want to say, hey, the person's Jewish, even if they don't necessarily do their research so extensively. That's where Moshe writes.
Is that really the case? Because I mean, they're regulated as well, and then if they found out to be producing false information, it'll backfire.
So again, maybe what Rav Moshe means is that they don't have an incentive to do more research than would be necessary in order not to get into trouble. Let's put
is
it that way.
Is there a reference at the CRC if someone wants to adopt today whether they should adopt non-Jewish or Jewish?
No, we don't get that question so much. We get a different question nowadays. We're living in different times. And nowadays, more than we get questions regarding adoptions, we get questions about surrogate motherhood, where, for example, there's a couple and they're not able to give birth to a child in terms of fully participating in the process, but they can have a child through some type of a donor egg that's contributed by somebody else, and the mother is able to carry the child once it's implanted in her womb, or the other way around, where the mother is the genetic mother. Maybe she froze her eggs, and they have to find the gestational carrier. They have to find somebody else who's going to be able to carry the child.
Is that and then the allowed?
And this is something which most poskim allow if it's the only way that the couple will be able to have children. Yes, but then the question is, who do you use as the surrogate mother, either the surrogate carrier or the donor of the egg? Is it better to use somebody else who's Jewish? Again, let's assume a single Jewish woman who's willing to do it, or is an unrelated single Jewish woman who might be willing to do it, or is it better to use a non-Jew? If you use a non-Jew, so then there's a big machlokus between the poskim as to whether the halachic mother is the contributor of the donor egg, the genetic mother, or whether the halachic mother is the gestational carrier, the person who gives birth. According to the Imre Yosher of Meir Arik, according to the modern day posek, Rizam Nechemya Goldberg, Zatzal passed away a year ago, the gestational mother, the one who carries the baby, is the one who's defined halachically as the Jewish mother. What was the Dr. Seuss book? Horton lays an egg or something, right? I think that was it, where there's like a bird who asks Horton the elephant to sit on her egg and so forth, and then at the end, the baby bird, the chick is hatched and it looks like an elephant, and because after all, the Horde and the elephant is the one who invested all of the time and energy and effort in order to bring this bird into the world. And Dr. Seuss points out at the end that that's not really the way it works. Really, the chick is going to look like the bird. I mean, the bird is going to look like the bird who laid the egg rather than like the elephant who sat on the egg. But he says, but isn't that the way it should be? Kind of like an interesting philosophical question. But leaving, that aside, so this is, very, very halacha l'maisa, that whole dilemma, that whole question. And then there is more and more of a cadre of contemporary poskim, including Rav Shlomo Amar, including Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zatzal, including what is reported as the opinion of Rav Avadya Yosef Zatzal, although I don't know that it was necessarily published so explicitly, a whole roster of poskim who feel that the real halakhic mother is the genetic mother, the one who donates the egg. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that it's really, and it's a question how you interpret different midrashim, which may not be halacha l'maaseh, regarding the switcheroo that took place in the various embryos of Rachel and Leah when it came to Yosef and Dina, and the Medrash can sort of cut, both ways in terms of the halacha l'maaseh understanding of who's the real halachic mother. The sugyas about orla, if you graft, an orla branch onto a tree that's already 3 years old, is it considered like orla, not considered like orla? The various sugyas that are discussed, the sugya about a mother who converts when she has two twins who are inside of her womb, and they're still, even though they're considered converts, but they're still considered to be brothers. So, how do you understand that in terms of its relevance for this question? But at the end of the day, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says that since it's not clear one way or another, there are different opinions in halacha. You have the opinion of Rabbi Bleich, who says, why do you have to pick and choose which one is the halachic mother? They're both halachic mothers. That they both, to a certain degree, are considered to be the mothers of this child. So Rav Shlomo Zalman says that to be on the safe side, you always have to do a gear. You always have to do a conversion. So we do a conversion in all of these cases. And this comes up, quite a bit, where people say, well, is it better to have somebody who's Jewish, or is it better to have somebody who's not Jewish and require a gear? So the advantage of having somebody who is a Jewish is that you don't need a conversion. It's not necessary to go through the conversion process. The baby is born Jewish, and you don't have to have a bez and approve, so to speak, of the family and decide whether the family is appropriate for a conversion process. The disadvantage is that you have to, ideally, you should make sure that you know the identity of the other, you know, Jewish donor, so that when this child grows up, the child won't end up marrying their half-brother or their half-sister. You know, there's problem, Shem Yisa Achas Achoso, which is the problem that, you know, we always speak about in the Gemara. And you also want to make sure that there are, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, you can never get into trouble for a child who is born outside of the context of an intimate relationship. If it's an artificial insemination then is used to fertilize an egg and implant an embryo in a womb, so you can never have a mamzerus, you can never have any kind of a psul come from that relationship. But not everybody agrees with Rav Moshe Feinstein. I think we mentioned that when we spoke about mamzerus. So according to those who, like the Tzitz Eliezer, who aren't so convinced by this Savara, then in the event that, let's say, this woman would be the wife's sister or somebody else who would potentially create, you know, a mamzerus situation, if the man's seed would go into this woman, or let's say that she's an Ashes Ish, she's married to another man, she's not a single woman who's carrying the child, so then you can have, you know, mamzeus, you can have yuxin problems. So you have to, so it's a little bit of a challenge in terms of balancing those considerations. The other consideration, which you have to take into account, is that let's say that that the wife is going to be the egg donor, and you'll have another Jewish woman, let's say a single Jewish woman who's unrelated, so there wouldn't be any mamzerus problems or anything of that sort. Let's say she's going to be the gestational carrier. And let's say that 5 years later, she comes back and she says, well, I know that I signed a contract saying that the child will belong exclusively to the donor egg mother, but halakhically speaking, I am not bound by that contract because I consider halakhically this child to be my child, and I'm going to take the donor egg mother and the husband to Beis Din, and I'm going to petition for visitation rights or custodial rights with respect to the child. There's a tshuva, I think by the Mabit, in which he says that if you had a, let's say, a man and a woman who had a child together, and then they got divorced, let's say, and the woman said she's giving up all of her custodial rights, that it's not a binding obligation. Let's say that there's a daughter, and according to the halacha, daughters generally stay with the mothers. Again, it's not an absolute rule. It depends on best interest of the child. But the Gemara does say, up until the age of six, the children stay with the mother, and then afterwards, the boy should be with the father, and the girl should be with the mother, as sort of a default premise. So let's say this woman says that I know I waived my right, but now I want to revoke that waiver because I don't think it should be enforceable because it's not in the best interest of the child. So I think it's the Mabit says that in such a case the mother wins that argument because she had no right to give away what was in the best interest of the child to be with her mother. So if she gave up the rights of the daughter to be able to, you know, be with the mother, just because the mother gave up that right, the daughter never gave up her right to be able to be with her mother. So therefore, this gestational mother might say, you know, I hold like Rav Meir Arik and like Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, I'm the real mother. The secular contract is not a binding contract, and I want this adjudicated in Beis Din, and the Beis Din might say that she has the right to visitation rights. So that, I don't know if this ever happening. I don't know if this ever happening. But technically speaking, it is a halakhic peril that such a thing could happen. While on the other hand, if the arrangement is made with a non-Jewish gestational carrier, so that non-Jew would be bound by, even according to halacha, not only according to secular law, but according to halacha, the non-Jew would be bound by dina d'malchus sedina. And if according to the secular law, when she enters into her contract saying she's going to have nothing to do with the child, that she can't revoke that waiver at a later point in time, then she won't be able to revoke it in a bez din either. And that therefore, it's a safer arrangement for the couple to arrange for the, in this example, for example, for the gestational mother to be a non-Jew. So it's kind of an interesting question. There's, I mean, you brought up, so, I mean, you sparked this discussion, so I'll go with it for a little bit. But, you know, it comes
can I
up.
Add in one thing?
Yeah, sure, please.
I answered my first this question about 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Can you have someone else carry you or your wife's? And his exact words were, it's Kamase stone.
Okay, but
it's evolved,
not everybody, but I think it's evolved.
I know a woman in Tina for a woman who wasn't gestational.
Yeah, I can tell you. I can tell you it's done. I can tell you it's done, and
that's
it's especially
and with respect.
And with respect, maybe, but with respect to sort of the position of the poskim, the poskim are generally very sympathetic to the very strong desire for a couple to be able to bring their own child into the world.
But has and it evolved over the course of
I
the
think
years?
It definitely has evolved over the course of the years, and and this is something which has become much more widespread. Now, of course, you need to have a certain amount of supervision to make sure that the husband's zera is not being switched with somebody else's zera, and that's why you have entire organizations like Machon Pua that supervise these things. The most common type of case of what you might call IVF, you know, that type of a procedure, would be a case where it's the husband and the wife were just using their own material, their own genetic material, that for whatever reason they can't have a child in the normal course. So there's artificial insemination with the husband's zera, and then it helps to fertilize an egg that belongs to the wife, and you know it's planted in her womb, or maybe the zera goes directly into her. However, you know it's going. However, it's arranged. It's usually just the husband and the wife, but sometimes for whatever reason the wife is not able to do both, to donate the egg, to be the genetic donor, and also to be the egg carrier, and therefore you need somebody to help out. But this way she's at least doing half of the process. Now, according to, as I said, a lot of poskim say that the gestational mother is like she's like a UPS delivery person, and that the real halakhic mother is the genetic donor. So what ends up happening is that it raises, you know, this question of when that happens, if you do use a non-Jew, so then the question becomes, can you have a more lenient standard of geirus? That normally, there's a big machlokus between the poskim about when you have, let's say, a couple that adopts a child, getting back to adoption for a moment, when they adopt a child, what's the standard for a bez din to, if the child is not Jewish, to convert the child to Judaism? So the Gemara says in Suvas and Daf Yud Aleph, Ger Katan Mapilin also Das Bezdin. If you have a young child, so the Bezdin is the one that has to make the determination that the child, that it's appropriate to bring this child into the fold of the Jewish people. So how does the Bezdin make that determination? Normally, when a person becomes a convert to Judaism, they have to accept Kabbalah so mitzvahs. They have to accept the yoke of commandments. How does a child, how does a two-week-old child, a two-month-old child, a three-year-old child, how does a child accept, how do they have the das, how do they have the requisite mindset to accept the yoke of commandments? So that's the idea of al das bezdin, the way the most meforshim understand it, based on the Gemara, is that it works based on the principle of zakon liadam shlo b'fanav. That you can, for example, decide that you're going to give a gift to somebody, and you have that gift delivered on behalf of this individual, and then this somebody accepts it on their behalf, and it's considered to belong to them, provided that they don't revoke the gift and say they don't want it. So how does that work? Yeah, we assume that most people want gifts. Most people enjoy gifts. So we say, talking that it's considered like it's transferred to their possession as long as somebody accepts it on their behalf, unless they're saveach, unless they scream and yell as soon as they find out about it that they don't want it. So it's the same principle over here. We assume that it's a zechus, that it's an unmitigated benefit for somebody to join the Jewish people. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that if they scream and yell when they find out, when they have the requisite mindset, the requisite intelligence to make a decision whether or not they want to be Jewish, and they scream and yell at that point in time that they don't want to be Jewish, so then all bets are off. That's why the Gemara says in Suva Sigdili Yecholon Limchos, that when a boy who was converted or the girl who was converted reached bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah age, so then Yecholon Limchos, they could say, I don't want this. I don't want this gift. That's the idea. But Rav Elia Pujanor, who was related to Rav Soloveitchik, was one of the grandfathers, I think it was the maternal grandfather of Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. So he wrote a sefer called Migdanos Eliyahu. And in that sefer, he makes the point that if you look at the various sugyas in the Gemara, we don't say that anything can be transferred to another individual based on this principle, Zakun Ladam Shlobafana. It has to be something which, objectively speaking, would be viewed as beneficial. So he says that you have to look at the moment in the context of conversion, you have to look at the moment in which the conversion takes place to determine, is it objectively beneficial at that point in time? What's considered to be objectively beneficial when it comes to a minor child? So the Sri Deyesh says, and Rav Kook says in his the Shailos Teshuvas Das Kohen, and others say as well, that in order for it to be an unmitigated benefit for the child, it has to be that the child is going to be brought up in a home of Torah mitzvot, so that the child is going to get lots and lots of reward for doing mitzvot and will be unlikely to have to worry that much about getting punishment for doing averos, because they're going to be reared in a home that is centered around kashrus and Shabbos and shmiras and mitzvot, and the child is going to be sent to day school and so forth. But if the child is not going to be reared in such a home, the child's not going to be brought up in an atmosphere of Torah mitzvot, so then it's clearly not a benefit for the child. According to Rav Elia Pujanor, even if it turns out that at the time that the geirus was performed, there was no expectation that the family was going to keep Torah mitzvot, and then they had suddenly an awakening. They went to an Esha Torah seminar or something a couple of years later, and they said, wow, you know, we've decided that we want to devote our lives to Torah mitzvot. If that wasn't a realistic expectation at the time of the conversion, so he would say the conversion would still be, according to his litmus test about Zakon Lan Mishlo Bafana, the conversion would still be invalid according to that test. Now, at the same time, you have another cadre of poskim made up of the Beis Yitzchak of Yitzchak Shmelkis and Rav Moshe Feinstein, who say, what are you talking about? It's always a benefit to be Jewish. It's always a benefit to be converted to Judaism, because think about it. If the child is going to keep it, lots of mitzvot, so the child is going to get lots and lots of reward. Let's say that the child's not going to keep mitzvot because the child wasn't brought up in a frum home and it wasn't fully appreciate Torah mitzvot. So then the child is like a tinok shenishpa. The child doesn't know any better. So the child's not going to be punished when he or she gets older for not keeping mitzvot, because they're onus rachmana patre. They don't know about Torah mitzvot. So therefore, they can only win and they can't lose. That's the way that Rav Moshe writes about it. Rav Moshe says that's not a lechatzkila. He says that's something that you can, you know, maybe rely upon b'di'evit. He doesn't encourage converting children in that type of a setting where the parents are not going to keep Torah mitzvot. But he has a case, I think it involved a school in Indianapolis, if I'm not mistaken, that he speaks about in one of his tshuvas, where somebody asked him a question saying, we're teaching in this Talmud Torah, this Jewish day school, and a number of the children are not halakhically Jewish because the fathers are Jewish and the mothers are not Jewish. Is it okay to teach Torah to these non-Jewish children? Because we say that you're not supposed to teach Torah to non-Jews. You're only supposed to teach Torah to Jews, right? Right, we say that every single day. Mishpatim ba'yudum. You're not supposed to do that. The whole goy. You're not supposed to teach a non-Jew's Torah. So they asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, "Is it okay to teach the children Torah?" And he said, you know, it's a real problem. It's true. Some of the kids are Jewish, so maybe it's okay with some of the kids, but I have a great solution for you. He said, just convert them. Because since the parents are anyway sending the children to a school, which is an Orthodox school, where they're learning Torah and mitzvot, so even though the mother's not Jewish, the mother's not clearly in the home, these children were not getting an unadulterated, you know, Torah atmosphere. If the father was Jewish and the mother wasn't Jewish, but Moshe said, you can convert the children anyway, because of the fact that it's a sechus for them, that they're being brought up through an Orthodox Jewish education, that's good enough. So not everybody would say that, and some people would say, well, the proof is going to be in the pudding. At the end of the day, is the child going to, with it, that type of an educational atmosphere where they have Torah in the school, but not necessarily Torah in the home, are they going to end up being observant or not? And many say years later, they don't think it worked out that way. That if the child was really raised in a home in America where the father was Jewish and the mother wasn't, even if they did go to an Orthodox day school, generally they didn't remain in the fold. They didn't complete the course of Yiddishkeit completely in their formative years, and they didn't end up so firm. So this is a question mark. The general policy that we follow, I'll take your question in a moment. The general policy that we follow, because as you may know, I serve as the chairman of the GPS committee for the Rabbinical Council of America. What's the GPS committee? The GPS is the network of conversion courts of Batei Din for Gir all over North America that are under the auspices of the Rabbinical Council of America and the Beit Din of America. And we have a committee of rabbis that review our standards and procedures. It's called GPS. GPS is a very, you know, glamorous name. Stands for Geirus Policies and Standards. Okay, very boring, but it's a navigation system. Although we wasn't named after the navigation system. The navigation system became popular after we created the GPS. I'm not going to go into that. No lawsuit was ever filed. It's quite all right. But I think that they really existed before, and people just didn't know about them so much. But the GPS has to formulate standards for conversion. So we'll have uniform standards. And the fact that we have uniform standards and people all over the world, Rabbanim all over the world, know what our standards are, know who our Dayanim are, so it gives us a good reputation. And one of the great things that the GPS has accomplished is that anybody who gets converted through the GPS, their conversion is automatically accepted by the Rabbanut in Israel, because we worked together with the Rabbanut when we formulated the GPS in the first place, because there was a big problem that people were going through conversions with all kinds of ad hoc batei din in America. Some were good and some were not as good. And therefore, when the converts would go, or the children of the converts, would, if they were female converts, would go to Israel years later, so the Rabbanut in Israel would not accept anybody's conversion. Say we have to do a de novo review of every single conversion. It would drive people crazy. It was just a bureaucratic nightmare, and also a personal, heart-wrenching, emotional nightmare for all these people who went through a conversion process. So we felt it was very important to have a system that everybody would respect. And Baruch Hashem, it's really been L'Shem L'Sifes. But our official standard at the GPS is that when it comes to converting minor children, let's say there are parents who adopt the children, who adopt a child, so then we have adopted the stricter standard. Our postgame, Shechter, Rabbi Willig, the various postgame, including Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zatzal, believed in the stricter standard that it's only really a zechus, it's only really a benefit for a child to be converted to Judaism if they're going to be brought up in an Orthodox home, which means that the parents have to belong to an Orthodox shul, if they're going to be sent to Orthodox schools, and if there's going to be an atmosphere of Shmir Shabbos and Kashrus in the home. And that is a pretty rigorous standard, because it used to be that you would have conservative families, conservative couples would come to the Bezin and say, please convert our child. They would say, we can't convert the child unless you change your affiliation to an Orthodox shul, and you start sending, and you can commit to sending your children to Orthodox schools and so forth. So that's a pretty rigorous standard. So Rabbi Ezra Bick, who's a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Taharat Zion, I believe in Israel, Gush. So he wrote a letter a number of years ago that I thought made sense. I thought the letter made sense. I thought it was, you know, a reasonable argument. It hasn't been widely accepted. And the letter said like this. It was a letter to the Asya Journal. Asya is a medical halakha journal. It made sense because he was talking about surrogate motherhood. And the letter said that we have a halacha in the Gemara in Gittin, a Mishnah Gemara in Gittin that talks about a person who is a chatzi eved chatzi ben choren. He's nishtahir. He's a sort of, you know, he's neither here nor there. He's half an eved kanaini and he's half freed. How do you have such a thing? Meaning he had two masters. One of the masters freed him, the other master didn't free him. Beis Hillel says he's stuck. Beis Shammai says we force the other master to free him because otherwise he can't marry anybody. He can't marry a regular Jewish woman because he's still a little bit of a Knaini. He can't marry a Shifka Knainis because he's a little bit of a freed man. So it's not fair to make somebody sit and not be able to get married and not be able to fulfill Pruavu. And Beis Hillel finally came around to the thinking of Beis Shammai and said, you know what, you're right. So says Rabbi Bick, it's the same thing for this poor fellow. A fellow has two mothers. One of them's Jewish, one of them's not Jewish, one of them's gestational mother, the other one is the donor egg mother, and you have a big machlokas between all these poskim. Is they Jewish, not Jewish? The person's sort of half Jewish, according to some people's Jewish, because other people, so it can't be a goy, because maybe he's Jewish. It can't be Jewish, because maybe he's a goy. So he's stuck. He can't marry anybody, he can't do it, he doesn't know who he is, love it, but it's a complete identity, existential crisis for the rest of his life. So he says, it's always a zuchus. Even if the parents aren't going to be so observant, it's just intrinsically, it is the definitionally a zuchus to convert this child. So you don't have to have necessarily, you shouldn't have to require the same rigorous standard in this particular case. Maybe you have the more lenient standard when it comes to doing such conversion. So I thought, you know what, this makes a lot of sense. I thought it made sense to me. So we had a Gavis conference a number of years ago in which we were discussing various issues, and Rav Herschel Schechter, Shlita, was there at the conference as kind of the reigning posek at the time. Still, is the reigning posek of the GPS. I may have asked him good help. So I said to I asked Rav Schechter, what do you think about this? Do you think that we can adopt the more lenient standard? So Rav Schechter said, I don't know. Which meant no. So I wanted to make sure I understood it correctly, because truthfully, we have cases like this that come up now, and especially in light of the fact that according to more and more poskim, the real halakhic mother is defined in terms of the genetic mother. It seems that the preponderance of cases we're getting now are cases where the Jewish mother is the donor egg mother, and it's just a question of doing a geirus l'chumrah, of doing a conversion because the gestational carrier mother was not Jewish. So I decided I'm going to approach Rav Schechter again, because, you know, why should I, you know, affect, you know, our policy based on my interpretation of I don't know. Maybe I don't know really meant I don't know. But, you know, I'm a Talmud of Rav Schechter for many decades, so I have a pretty good sense of, you know, based on the inflection and, you know, the delivery of what I don't know means. So I sat down last week. It happens that I was at YU for my monthly trip. So I sat down with Rav Schechter, asked him a bunch of things. This is one of the things that I asked Rav Schechter. I said, did I understand you correctly when I raised this question a number of years ago, that you really felt that it should be exactly the same standard, based on the fact that once you're doing a conversion anyway, what's the point of doing the conversion? What does it mean to do a conversion unless you're going to have a rigorous standard? Otherwise, it's not really a conversion. So he said, yes, 100% that's what he meant. I understood him correctly. Baruch Hashem, I understood him correctly. But that, you know, poses a question with respect to these types of cases. So in that, let's say that you were dealing with a couple that, for whatever reason, wasn't ready to fully commit themselves to Torah mitzvahs. Hopefully they will. Sometimes they say, just give us time. It'll take, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years, whatever it will be. But they're not there just yet. And therefore, we can't perform the conversion, even the chumrah, based on our standard. So if that couple would come to us and say, is it better to have a Jewish carrier or a non-Jewish carrier? So for them, probably would be better to have a Jewish carrier, as long as you don't run afoul of these other problems of like potential mamzerus yuchsin issues. You make sure to identify who the person is, so you remember for the future, you know, in terms of making sure that a brother doesn't marry his half-sister and so forth, and make sure that it's a single woman who's not, so you don't have these questions of a married woman, you don't have a question of a woman who's a relative. One of the questions that I received not so long ago was somebody who wanted to have their sister be the gestational carrier. They were there because they figured that they want to keep it in the family, wanted to make sure that they're comfortable with the genetic materials. They figured they'll be the donor egg mother, and their sister is a single woman. She'll be the gestational carrier. So I spoke to Rabbi Willig about it at the time. Rabbi Willig said, that's a really, really bad idea. For lots of reasons. If you think about it, I mean, from a psychological perspective, it's really like a bad idea. Just objectively speaking, even leaving out all the halakha considerations. But if you throw in the halakha considerations as well, so that's going to be more problematic, at least according to some poskim. So why put yourself into that type of a quandary? So that's if you're dealing with these types of questions regarding who should you adopt in the first place. But if you or what gestational mother should you use in the first place? But so that Marshall, and just to make a what could have been a short answer, very, very long, but this is still probably an interesting fuller presentation. That's the type of question that we get more commonly nowadays in terms of picking who the person is going to be. In terms of the question of is it better to adopt a Jewish child, or is it better to adopt a non-Jewish child? So I think that if people had their druthers, they definitely would want to adopt, a Jewish child. They don't have to go through the conversion process, and the person's already Jewish. And we mentioned last week that there are sugyas in the Gemara that talk about what a tremendous mitzvah it is. You take this Jewish child who doesn't have parents to raise them, and you raise the child. The Rav Shlomo Kluger says that Ki'ilu Yoldo means that if you had a childless couple and they adopted a Jewish child, they could even fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Avu. Not everybody agrees with Rav Shlomo Kluger to say that they actually, on a deraisa level, are satisfied that they would perform the mitzvah of Pru Avu. And it obviously wouldn't be their biological child, that there wouldn't be a halakhic, that there wouldn't be a Yerusha. The child wouldn't inherit the parents according to strict halakha. Obviously, arrangements can be made and should be made for the child to inherit their parents, in a way that works. The child wouldn't sit avelus, according to strict halakha, wouldn't have a full-fledged mitzvah. Well, we spoke about kibbud av v'aim. According to Rav Melech Shefter, maybe they have a higher obligation kibbud av, but it's different. It's different. So that would be, an ideal world. Obviously, it raises these questions that the No Debuta raised, that if you know the mother's identity, but you don't know the father's identity, so you have this problem of shtuki. Because the Gemara says that if you ask the mother, who's the father, and the mother says, I'm not going to tell you, you don't know the identity of the father, you have to be worried, maybe it was a mamzer. Maybe it was a mamzer. Maybe it was somebody who was puzzled. So the No Debuta Yehuda said, well, why aren't we worried about a case of an asufi? The Gemara says an asufi, if you just find, a child who's lying around, you don't know who the father is or who the mother is, but it's a Jewish neighborhood and the child is Jewish. So then we say that's also a problem, but it's not a problem if the child was taken very good care of, because if there would have been something wrong with the child, then the parents never, or the mother, never would have, given in the child to an adoption agency, or dressed the child up so nicely and beautifully when it was left at the doorstep, right? The No Debuta says, but wait a second, but isn't every Asufi also a Shtuki? So why is it that if an Asufi is packaged very nicely and very beautifully, so we're not worried about the legitimacy of the child, but if I just also happen to find out the mother's identity, so now I have a problem? So one answer is, well, because maybe in the case of the Asufi, we can assume it was a married couple that for whatever reason just couldn't take care of the child, but the child was born under legitimate circumstances. But if I know that the mother was a single woman and that it wasn't under, and that it was not under circumstances of a married couple, so then I have to be more worried that maybe she had the child with somebody who was a mamzer. Most people in the world are not mamzerim. That's what the Gemara says. I'm worried that instead of the person going to her, in which case we would say, called the parish, maybe she went to them. in which case they're a kabua. They're in a particular location. And when, like when you buy meat and there are nine kosher stores and one non-kosher store, so even though there's only one non-kosher store, if I went into the store to buy the meat, so since in that particular place it was kabua, it was nikka, it was recognizable, and it was clearly established in that place that there was non-kosher meat, and maybe I went into that store, I say ko kabua kemetza mechzadami. That it's not considered a 90% chance that I bought kosher meat. It's considered a 50% chance that I bought non-kosher meat. And therefore, I have to be worried I'm not going to be able to eat that meat. That's the case of kavua. If I found nimtza, I found the meat out on in the parking lot, you know, outside of all these stores. Assuming that you're comfortable eating meat that's, you know, sitting in the parking lot. So then I can assume that it came from one of the nine kosher stores, because I say called the parish, meruba parish. So the Noda Biyuda says that you can be makel in the case of the one, he gives an explanation, you could be makel in the case of a Sufi, because I don't have to worry about, I'm not judging the woman, because I don't know who the woman is. I'm just judging the child. The child, for sure, is parish. The child separated from wherever, you know, the original actor took place of this intercourse. So therefore, I say that the child is kosher when the child is dressed up nicely. So he says, by the same token, with respect to a shtuki, I only have to be machmir about the child if I'm judging the mother. But if I'm not judging the mother, because the mother, let's say, died a long time ago, and I'm only looking at the child, so then I can say about the child called the parish, meruba parish. That's the chiddush of the Noda Biyuda. So Noda Biyuda says, at least in a case where we have no idea where the mother is anymore, like, well, maybe once upon a time we knew where the mother was, but we don't know where the mother is anymore, maybe, and the mother might even be dead. So then there might be room to be mako based on the Noda Biyuda. Now, the Piskei Tshuva in Sores Above, the Piskei Tshuva says that he quotes the Beis Meir and the Kilos Yaakov of the Gaon Milisa of the Nebal HaNesivos as saying they don't understand what the Noda Biyuda is talking about. He says it's not true, because the moment in which, because we say about the child, a child is not a piece of meat. A child actually is a part and parcel of this mother. And if I have to be machmir regarding the mother, so the child is never parish. The child is considered to be uber yerach imahu. The child is considered to be like one of the limbs of the mother. If we say that there was a problem with the mother, even if right now I'm not judging the mother, whenever I have the child in front of me, I'm effectively judging the mother. I'm judging what happened during that relationship, because that is when the suffix, when the question mark regarding the father arose. So therefore, the question mark regarding the mother arose at that point in time. So that's when the question mark regarding the child arose as well, at exactly the same time. So therefore, they are not keen and all about this approach regarding the Noda Biyuda. Now, if you look in the Shev Shmaitasa, the famous, you know, sefer written by the Baal HaKitzos, so he says, take a look at Sur Zion, if you have it. If you don't have it, just listen to me for a moment. That which the Noda Biyuda said, it's against most of the poskim. So this is an interesting question, because what's happening now is that we are discovering more and more in these adoption cases, once we follow the approach of Moshe Feinstein, and we say that we are not going to be comfortable relying on the records of the adoption agency alone. And maybe, Marshall, you could be more makel when the adoption agency was testifying like 50, 60 years ago, before Jews were being defined in terms of patrilineal descent, you know, in the Reform community and stuff like that. And Rabbi Gedaliah Dov Schwartz had a rule of thumb. His rule of thumb was, if you have both the testimony of the adoption agency that the mother was Jewish, plus it was a Jewish adoption agency, so you know that the vast majority of the children there were Jewish, so you could rely upon that combination in terms of assuming that the child was Jewish. But unfortunately, they don't exist. They don't exist. By and large, they don't exist. In most of our cases, even if the adoption agency says unambiguously the mother was Jewish, they're generally not Jewish adoption agencies. So we don't really have that combination. But now we're able to, so if you'd say, follow a Moshe, and just assume that the child is really not Jewish, so one thing you don't have to worry about is shtuki, right? You don't have to worry about yuchsin issues, because with non-Jews, you don't have to worry about yuchsin, because they're just not, either they're non-Jewish, or if they convert, they're 100% kosher as a ger. A convert doesn't come with any baggage. A convert is 100% kosher. That's why we said with mamzerim, the best thing for a mamzer is to marry a shivka kninus, and then the children will not be considered to be Jewish, and then when they convert, they'll be considered 100% kosher. There won't be any stigma of mamzerus upon them. But now, so I had a case. I have cases. I'm not going to go into individual. I'll talk generically. Generically, because I'm not looking to betray confidences. So generically, we have cases from time to time where a person will come in and will say, look, we can't prove that you're a Jewishness because you were adopted, your mother was adopted, and the records, you know, are not absolutely conclusive. No problem. We'll do a Giyur L'chumrah. We'll convert you. And the person says, but I'm not ready to accept to be Shomer Shabbos. I'm not ready to keep mitzvahs. The woman I want to marry is not ready to be observant. I can't do that at this point in time. And then we're stuck because we can't do the Giyur L'chumrah. But now more and more, and this is probably going to happen more and more as time goes on, we're able to actually identify the real birth mothers, the real birth grandmothers, whoever they happen to be. How are we doing that? Through DNA analysis. And even if they never submitted their own personal DNA, they generally have family members because people are very curious in this day and age. That's what we're living in. We're living in times which people are just very curious and they're willing to give blood samples, you know, of themselves or whatever, cell samples or whatever else to find out more about their genealogy. And people are doing 23andMe. And you can't stop people from doing 23andMe. What's 23andMe? 23 chromosomes and me, right? You know, we all have them. And people are submitting this to these labs where they're making the determinations of other people who have submitted 23andMe tests, and they're discovering who their first cousins or the second cousins are, because if it's a sibling, they'll have 25% of the same DNA. If it's a first cousin, they'll have 6% of the same DNA. Based on these percentages and the like, they can figure out who's related to whom, first cousins once removed, and so forth. And we're discovering, and we have other clues that we're able to piece together, like good detectives, and we can figure out, you know, who the grandmothers are and so forth. And sometimes they're actually still alive. If people thought that they would never be found out, well, it's becoming less and less true. But then you discover the identity of the individual, so that's great. You're able to prove Jewishness. Isn't that wonderful? But what about the Shtuki problem? We know, you know, if we find out, you know, who the paramour was, okay, so we can figure out if the person was kosher or not, but you can't always necessarily find out who it was. So do you have to worry about the Shtuki type of issue? You track the person down. You can't really have these conversations nowadays. Maybe in the times of the Gemara, you can have these conversations. Oh, you know, so first you establish that, you know, the person is really the mother, is really the grandmother, and maybe they'll tell you that. But then I don't think you can have the next conversation. So tell me, who was the guy, you know, the guy who, you know, got you pregnant, and was he a kosher Jew? You know, first of all, we'll hang up the phone with respect to the first question. And secondly, with respect to the second question, they don't know what you're talking about. Most of you are not going to know what you're talking about. You know, are you sure he wasn't a mamzer? You know, so Shlomo Duchovsky, when he was writing about these issues, so he actually said that, well, maybe you could just ask the question sort of generally. They don't know what it means, but they'll say, yeah, you seem like a fine person, you know, and he said, okay, fine. So maybe that's good enough. But truth of the matter is that you have many situations, it's just very uncomfortable to raise the question altogether. Who talks about this? The Asei L'Chorav of Chaim David Alevi, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, talks about this. Rav Isser Yehuda Unterman, who in his Sefer Shevet Yehuda, he talks about such cases as well, where you can't really, sometimes you can't really approach the person. It's just incredibly uncomfortable. You're opening up old wounds, whatever. So they talk about, are there other arguments besides what the Noda Yehuda presented that you can rely upon? So let's look first at the Shev Shemaitisa, and we'll go through, I lied when I said it'll be a little shorter today, I apologize. So we'll look at the Shev Shemaitisa, that is source Zion. So he says like this, if we're going to say that the child, remember the Gemara said, the whole idea of Shtuki is really a mala asu biyuchsin. The whole thing is like a chumra biyama. Because maybe the woman didn't go to her paramour, maybe he came to her, in which we would be able to go after Rove. The whole thing is a mala biyuchsin. So he says, "Bezenir b'shas hadchak." So therefore, if you're in a really stuck in a tough situation, lismach ashitas Rashi b'alamor the svilu sagi b'chad Rove. There are Rishonim that say that as long as a majority of people in the neighborhood where the woman gave birth are kosher to her, And remember, for purposes of the child being kosher, what does that mean? It means that either the man was not a mamzer, or not, you know, a close incestuous, you know, relative to her, right? Or he was a non-Jew, because if she gives birth from a non-Jew, it's also going to be a kosher Jew. So the vast majority of Jews and non-Jews together are going to lead to a kosher child. And therefore he says that also, even according to the poskim that say that I have to worry about kavua, that it's like considered 50-50, it's only 50-50 if I know that there's a mamzer in the city. But we don't keep registries nowadays of mamzerim. We don't keep registries of mamzerim. So he says that where you don't have like known mamzerim, you don't have to worry about it. And he says a very interesting line, ve'ina lo shir klal afilu miut. We don't even have like a miut of people who are known to be mamzerim. You have people walk into the shul and say, oh, look, there's Chaim the mamzer. We don't have that per se. It's not part of our culture anymore that you identify people. I mean, I remember growing up, so there was Max the widower. You know, oh, there's Max the widower. You know, I would visit my great aunt in Bnei Brak. Oh, there's Chana Hagiyot. She's coming to visit. You know, so people were identified. So, but you didn't have people identified here. So and so the mom's there. You know, unless like your teacher was really angry at you in class. But you know, that was something else. But it wasn't that. You know, we were identifying, you know, people in terms of their halakhic status as mamzerim. So therefore, he says, "Mishum shash mamzer lo chai shinan." He says, "We don't have psule kahal like mitzri." What were some of the things we're worried about? Oh, there's like a mitzri you can't marry who's like in the first three generations, or you know, second generation mitzri, adomi, natini. We don't have them. Kulam nisbabalu. There are no such nations anymore, and we don't really have too many mamzerim. Mishum mamzer nami lo chai shinan neked lo kavia mamzer beir ba'kok sheir metzla. So therefore, he says, you don't have to worry about it. What about that she might have relatives in the city? So he says, we don't really worry about relatives because a relative is not kavua as a psul. A mamzer, wherever the mamzer is, he's kavua as a psul. A relative is only psul if he's going to have relations with a close relative, that you'll have a nephew who's going to have relative relations with his aunt. If the nephew is going to have relations with any of the other, you know, 5,000 women in the city, it's going to be perfectly fine. He's not intrinsically a psul. It's only a relational psul based on who the individual might be. So he says that doesn't count. That's an interesting chiddush because Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't seem to write that way, but that's what he says. So then the Ein Yitzchak of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan has a tshuva about this, in which he makes a different suggestion. He says that maybe we don't have to worry. He agrees as well that we don't have to worry about the mamzerim. But what about in terms of the close relatives? So he says we're not worried about the close relatives because there used to be a yetzahara, the people to have relations with close relatives. But then the Gemara says that they destroyed the yetzahara for arayos. So he says after they destroyed the yetzahara for arayos, so we don't worry about that anymore. And that's why your brother's allowed to be secluded with his sister. That we don't worry about you could at least on a short term basis. So that's his explanation. And then the Shevet Miyehuda quotes from the Ein Yitzchak. He doesn't love that explanation per se, but he gives, you know, other arguments. He says, number one, that mamzer vade lo shkia klal uklal, that for sure we hardly have any mamzerim nowadays. We call shekev medina senu, and certainly in our medina. Now, I gather from this line that he wrote this tshuva before he moved to Israel, I know, shebechol ha'arim arof him nochem, that in all the cities, most of the people are non-Jewish. He couldn't have been writing this when he was, you know, when he was in Tel Aviv. But he says that, you know, most of the residents are non-Jews. L'krovim lo chashin, and we don't worry about the relatives. No sabaze yish kan trei rubi. And he says, some posts can say, if I have trei rubi, I have two majorities. The majority of the people in the city were kosher vis-a-vis this woman, and the majority of the people who visited the city, rov sia, were also kosher. So according to some poskim, you can rely upon that. Plus, he throws in something else. He says, it's funny because it's like the cases we're dealing with right now. He was dealing with a case where the identity of the mother of the birth mother wasn't known for a long period of time, and then finally they found it out. So he said, wait a second. So for many years, this child was a kosher Asufi, because this child had been given over to an adoption agency and taken good care of and was wrapped in nice clothing and was given over very lovingly, in which case we say there's nothing to worry about. So the child already had a chazaka, a cheskas kashrus. You can't take the cheskas kashrus and then undermine it 20 years later if you're going to find the mother 20 years later. He says, maybe if you knew the mother was from day one, you could undermine it. But if the child started out becheskes kashrus, you're not allowed to undermine a person's cheskes kashrus unless you have two witnesses that there's something wrong with them. Very fascinating. V'yesh l'tzarv l'zeh, she'havlad huksak b'kashrus, kol hazman. So therefore he says that if it's a tzarek shav, he would say, nir elefini astaiti de'efshel ha'atiro, mibli libdok esayim. So I think I can go even further than on the W'yud and say, even if the mother's right in front of me, but for whatever reason, it's going to be really uncomfortable to ask the mother because, you know, she's not going to be comfortable answering the questions, or it's going to open up a can of worms because she's now married to somebody else and, you know, that person is going to say, wait a second, you had a child from a previous relationship, you never told me, and it's going to cause merivos or katatos. So then he says, under those circumstances, it's not necessary press the issue or to ask any more questions. Very, very fascinating. And Rosh Shlomo Duchovsky has this discussion, and he just concludes by saying, and we'll conclude with this for our shir for today. He concludes by saying, "Hotza ma'asishi." So the bottom line, practical, you know, conclusion of all of this is sheshtuki. These are not my words. I'm not like, you know, changing a gemara. I'm just, you know, reading the words of Shlomo Duchovsky. If you take a look, this is straight out of Tzuchumen, volume 33, volume Lamed Gimel of Tzuchumen. He writes, "Shtuki biyameinu eno pasul bo bekal." Shtuki nowadays is not pasul anymore. So even as somebody who meets all the criteria of shtuki, he says that halacha does not apply biyameinu. I'm trying to say, it doesn't apply in certain circumstances. You figure out, you have a rov here, you have a rov there, you have a chazaka, you have this argument, that argument, you can't speak to the mother. No, 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 forget it, all bets are off. Why? Number one, Barova Makomas ain't Mamzer Yiduah, as we said. Most places you don't have the registry of Mamzerim. V'eima Shimos Ma'akim Mechar Mamzerim. V'eretz Yisrael Kayemes V'shimas Mukvei Chisun. He says, it's true. In Eretz Yisrael, you do have a list of people who are not allowed to get married because they didn't pass the test. Their certificates were not recognized. About Gam Rishima Zuhe and Mamzerim Adoyim. But it's not a Rishima Mamzerim. It's a Mishima, people who, like, they didn't feel comfortable relying upon the Rabbanim who gave in the certificates for whatever other reason. But it's not because that there's a Mamzer Yadua. And the Rock Suffolk Mamzer. Maybe sometimes you have a Suffolk, but a Suffolk Mamzer, the Gemara wasn't talking about a Suffolk Mamzer. It was talking about a real Mamzer. And he says that in the event that you would have a tinok also who was born from a child that came from a sperm bank donation, so then he says, then that's another reason that you could be mako because, you know, we could rely on Rav Moshe that you can't, you know, create mamzeris in that type of a situation. So you have all of these different, you know, considerations that are, you know, become relevant nowadays. I sat down with Rav Schechter last week. I asked Rav Schechter, what do you think about, you know, all of these arguments with respect to the shtuki question as we're going to uncover more and more of these cases where we can actually figure out the identity of the grandmothers and so forth. So I said, do you feel comfortable relying upon sort of the tzira for the no debiuda and, you know, all these other considerations? And in fact, God willing, when the volume, the special volume that I'm editing of Hadarom, the Rabbinical Council of America Torah Journal, is going to be published in memory of Rabbi Gedaliah Dov Schwartz, as that's out, God willing, very soon, we're going to be publishing a lot of the unpublished tshuvas of Rav Schwartz. One of his tshuvas deals with this question, and where he says that you can rely upon the No Debi Yehuda, you know, nowadays, based on, you know, or the fact, like the Shev Shmaitis has said, that it is a do-or-die situation. You can't, you know, pass all of these people. So therefore, you can rely on the fact that we're really judging the child rather than judging the mother. So I asked Rosh Schechter whether he felt you could rely on all these considerations. And Rosh Schechter said he's going to look into it. So, okay, fine. He didn't want to give me an answer on the spot, but he said he's going to look into it. What? No, he didn't say I don't know. This wasn't an I don't know. This was that he really wanted to look into the sugi a little bit more because of the enormity of the question, which I respected. But I said I really would like to have your chavistas because I do see this as something that is, you know, affecting, you know, the bat they did in our determinations more and more. I spoke to Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Willig said we certainly can be stomach on the approach of, you know, Rabbi Schwartz for our purposes. But I'd like to get Rosh Schechter on record as well. You know, so we'll see what comes of that. But it's a very, very fascinating sugi, and, you know, this also, you know, runs to, you know, all of these, you know, questions of Jewish identity. Hashem, and next time around, we'll talk about, you know, these special populations, and then after that, we'll go on to the next topic. Okay, very good. Have a good night.
Regarding the...
Go ahead.
Yes. I have a whole list of questions.
No.
The first one is...